Chapter 10. Anyway, always ticking and striking, and getting you late for dinner. He glanced again at the clock in the tower. The hand stood at 9:03. I think, said Prince Michael, that I will sleep a little. The day has been fatiguing. He stretched himself upon a bench with the manner of one who had slept thus before. You will find me in this park on any evening, when the weather is suitable, said the prince, sleepily. Home to me when your marriage day is set, and I will give you a check for the money. Thanks, your highness, said the young man, seriously. Tea doesn't look as if I would need that palace on the Hudson, but I appreciate your offer, just the same. Prince Michael sank into deep slumber. His battered hat rolled from the bench to the ground. The young man lifted it, placed it over the frozy face, and moved one of the grotesquely relaxed limbs into a more comfortable position. Poor devil, he said, as he drew the tattered clothes closer about the prince's breast. Sonorous and startling came the stroke of 9 from the clock tower. The young man sighed again, turned his face for one last look at the house of his relinquished hopes, and cried aloud profane words of holy rapture. Greater than from the middle upper window blossomed in the dusk a waving, snowy, fluttering, wonderful, divine emblem of forgiveness and promised joy. By came a citizen, rotund, comfortable, home hurrying, unknowing of the delights of waving silken scarfs on the borders of dimly lit parks. Will you oblige me with the time, sir? Asked the young man, and the citizen, shrewdly conjecturing his watch to be safe, dragged it out and announced. 8:29, sir. And then, from habit, he glanced at the clock in the tower, and made further oration. By George! That clock's 30 minutes fast. First time in 10 years I've known it to be off. This watch of mine never varies, but the citizen was talking to vacancy. He turned and saw his ear, a fast receding black shadow, flying in the direction of a house with 3 lighted upper windows. And in the morning came along 2 policemen on their way to the beats they owned. The park was deserted save for one dilapidated figure that sprawled, asleep, on a bench. They stopped and gazed upon it. It's Dopey Mike, said one. He hits the pipe every night. Park bum for 20 years. On his last legs, I guess. The other policeman stooped and looked at something crumpled and crisp in the hand of the sleeper. Gee, he remarked. He's doped out a $50 bill, anyway. Wish I knew the brand of hop that he smokes. And then app, rap, rap, went the club of realism against the shoe soles of Prince Michael, of the electorate of Valleluna. Sisters of the Golden Circle, the Rubberneck Auto was about ready to start. The merry top riders had been assigned to their seats by the gentlemanly conductor. The sidewalk was blockaded with sightseers who had gathered to stare at sightseers, justifying the natural law that every creature on earth is preyed upon by some other creature. The megaphone man raised his instrument of torture. The inside of the great automobile began to thump and throb like the heart of a coffee drinker. The top riders nervously clung to the seats. The old lady from Valparaiso, Indiana, shrieked to be put ashore. But, before a wheel turns, listen to a brief preamble through the cardiophone, which'll point out to you an object of interest on life's sightseeing tour. Swift and comprehensive is the recognition of white man for white man in African wilds. Instant and sure is the spiritual greeting between mother and babe. Unhesitatingly do master and dog commune across the slight gulf between animal and man. Immeasurably quick and sapient are the brief messages between one and one's beloved. But all these instances set forth only slow and groping interchange of sympathy and thought beside one other instance which the rubberneck coach shall disclose. You shall learn, if you have not learned already, what two beings of all Earth's living inhabitants most quickly look into each other's hearts and souls when they meet face to face. The gong whirred, and the glaring at Gotham car moved majestically upon its instructive tour. On the highest, rear seat was James Williams, of Cloverdale, Missouri, and his bride. capitalize it. Friend typo that last word word of words in the epiphany of life and love. The scent of the flowers, the booty of the bee, the primal drip of spring waters, the overture of the lark, the twist of lemon peel on the cocktail of creation such as the bride. Holy is the wife, revered the mother, galliptious is the summer girl, but the bride is the certified check among the wedding presents that the gods send in when man is married to mortality. The car glided up the golden way. On the bridge of the great cruiser the captain stood, trumpeting the sights of the big city to his passengers. Wide-mouthed and open-eared, they heard the sights of the metropolis thundered forth to their eyes. Confused, delirious with excitement and provincial longings, they tried to make ocular responses to the megaphonic ritual. In the solemn spires of spreading cathedrals they saw the home of the Vanderbilts. In the busy bulk of the Grand Central Depot they viewed, wonderingly, the frugal cot of Russell Sage. Bidden to observe the islands of the Hudson, they gaped, unsuspecting, at the upturned mountains of a new-laid sower. To many the elevated railroad was the Rialto, on the stations of which uniformed men sat and made chop suey of ear tickets. And to this day in the outlying districts many have it that Chuck Connors, with his hand on his heart, leads reform, and that but for the noble municipal efforts of one Parkhurst, a district attorney, the notorious Bishop Potter gang would have destroyed law and order from the Bowery to the Harlem River. But I beg you to observe Mrs. James Williams Hattie Chalmers, that was once the belle of Cloverdale. Pale blue is the bride's, if she will, and this color as he had honored. Willingly had the moss rosebud loaned to her cheeks of its pink, and as for the violet, her eyes will do very well as they are, thank you. A useless strip of white chaffaux, no, he was guiding the auto car of white chiffon or perhaps it was grenadine, or tulle was tied beneath her chin, pretending to hold her bonnet in place. But you know as well as I do, that the hatpins did the work. And on Mrs. James Williams' face was recorded a little library of the world's best thoughts in three volumes. Volume number 1 contained the belief that James Williams was about the right sort of thing. Volume number 2 was an essay on the world, declaring it to be a very excellent place. Volume number 3 disclosed the belief that in occupying the highest seat in a rubberneck auto they were traveling the pace that passes all understanding. James Williams, you would have guessed, was about 24. It will gratify you to know that your estimate was so accurate. He was exactly 23 years, 11 months and 29 days old. He was well built, active, strong-jawed, good-natured and rising. He was on his wedding trip. Dear kind fairy, please cut out those orders for money and 40 HP touring cars and fame, and a new growth of hair, and the presidency of the boat club. Instead of any of them turn backward, oh, turn backward and give us just a teeny-weeny bit of our wedding trip over again. Just an hour, dear fairy, so we can remember how the grass and poplar trees looked, and the bow of those bonnet strings tied beneath her chin, even if it was the hatpins that did the work. Can't do it? Very well, hurry up with that touring car and the oil stock then. Just in front of Mrs. James Williams sat a girl in a loose tan jacket, and a straw hat adorned with grapes and roses. Only in dreams and milliners' shops do we, alas, gather grapes and roses at one swipe. This girl gazed with large blue eyes, credulous, when the megaphone man roared his doctrine that millionaires were things about which we should be concerned. Between blasts she resorted to Epictetian philosophy in the form of pepsin chewing gum. At this girl's right hand sat a young man about 24. He was well built, active, strong-jawed and good-natured. But if his description seems to follow that of James Williams, divested of anything Cloverdalian, this man belonged to hard streets and sharp corners. He looked keenly about him, seeming to begrudge the asphalt under the feet of those upon whom he looked down from his perch. While the megaphone barks at a famous hostelry, let me whisper you through the low-tuned cardiophone to sit tight, Therefore now things are about to happen, and the great city will close over them again, as over a scrap of ticker tape floating down from the den of a Broad Street bear. The girl in the tan jacket twisted around to view the pilgrims on the last seat. The other passengers as he had absorbed. The seat behind her was her Bluebeard's chamber. Her eyes met those of Mrs. James Williams. Between two ticks of a watch they exchanged their life's experiences, histories, hopes and fancies. And all, mind you, with eye, before two men could have decided whether to draw steel or borrow a match. The bride leaned forward low. She and the girl spoke rapidly together, their tongues moving quickly like those of two serpents, a comparison that is not meant to go further. Two smiles and a dozen nods closed the conference. And now in the broad, quiet avenue in front of the rubberneck car, a man in dark clothes stood with uplifted hand. From the sidewalk another hurried to join him. The girl in the fruitful hat quickly seized her companion by the arm and whispered in his ear. That young man exhibited proof of ability to act promptly. Crouching low, he slid over the edge of the car, hung lightly for an instant, and then disappeared. Half a dozen of the top riders observed his feat, wonderingly, but made no comment, deeming it prudent not to express surprise at what might be the conventional manner of alighting in this bewildering city. The truant passenger dodged a hansom, and then floated past, like a leaf on a stream between a furniture van and a florist's delivery wagon. The girl in the tan jacket turned again, and looked in the eyes of Mrs. James Williams. Then she faced about and sat still, while the rubberneck auto stopped at the flash of the badge under the coat of the plainclothes man. "What's eaten you?" demanded the megaphonist, abandoning his professional discourse for pure English. "Keep her at anchor for a minute," ordered the officer. "Here's a man on board we want, a Philadelphia burglar called Pinky McGuire. There he is on the back seat. Look out for the side, Donovan." Donovan went to the hind wheel, and looked up at James Williams. "Come down, old sport," he said, pleasantly. "I've got you. Back to Sleepy Town for yours. It ain't a bad idea, hiding on the rubberneck, though. I'll remember that." Softly through the megaphone, came the advice of the conductor. "Better step off, sir, and explain. The car must proceed on its tour." James Williams belonged among the level heads. With necessary slowness he picked his way through the passengers down to the steps at the front of the car. His wife followed. But she first turned her eyes and saw the escaped tourist glide from behind the furniture van and slip behind a tree on the edge of the little park, not 50 feet away. Descended to the ground, James Williams faced his captors with a smile. He was thinking what a good story he would have to tell in Cloverdale about having been mistaken for a burglar. The rubberneck coach lingered, out of respect for its patrons. What could be a more interesting sight than this? "My name is James Williams, of Cloverdale, Missouri," he said kindly, so that they would not be too greatly mortified. "Have letters here that will show you'll come with us, please," announced the plainclothes man. "Pinky McGuire's description fits you like flannel washed in hot suds. A detective saw you on the rubberneck up at Central Park, and phoned down to take you in. Do your explaining at the station house." James Williams' wife, his bride of 2 weeks, looked him in the face with a strange soft radiance in her eyes and a flush on her cheeks, looked him in the face and said, "Go with him quietly, Pinky, apostrophe, and maybe it'll be in your favor." And then as the glaring at Gotham car rolled away, she turned and threw a kiss, his wife threw a kiss at someone high up on the seats of the rubberneck. "Your girl gives you good advice, McGuire," said Donovan. "Oh man, now." And then madness descended upon and occupied James Williams. He pushed his hat far upon the back of his head. "My wife seems to think I am a burglar," he said, recklessly. "Never heard of her being crazy, therefore I must be. And if I'm crazy, they can't do anything to me for killing you two fools in my madness." Whereupon he resisted arrest so cheerfully and industriously that cops had to be whistled for, and afterwards the reserves, to disperse a few thousand delighted spectators. At the station house the desk sergeant asked for his name. McDoodle, the Pink, or Pinky the Brute, I forget which, was James Williams' answer. But you can bet I'm a burglar, don't leave that out. And you might add, that it took five of 'em to pluck the Pink. I'd especially like to have that in the records. In an hour, came Mrs. James Williams, with Uncle Thomas, of Madison Avenue, in a respect-compelling motor car, and proofs of the hero's innocence for all the world like the third act of a drama backed by an automobile MFG. Co. After the police had sternly reprimanded James Williams for imitating a copyrighted burglar, and given him as honorable a discharge as the department was capable of, Mrs. Williams rearrested him, and swept him into an angle of the station house. James Williams regarded her with one eye. He always said that Donovan closed the other while somebody was holding his good right hand. Never before had he given her a word of reproach or of reproof. If you can explain, he began rather stiffly. Why you, dear, she interrupted, listen. It was an hour's pain and trial to you. I did it for her, I mean the girl who spoke to me on the coach. I was so happy, Jim so happy with you, that I didn't dare to refuse that happiness to another. Jim, they were married only this morning those two, and I wanted them to get away. While they were struggling with you, I saw him slip from behind his tree and hurry across the park. That's all of it, dear, I had to do it. Thus does one sister of the plain gold man know another who stands in the enchanted light that shines but once and briefly for each one. By rice and satin bows does mere man become aware of weddings. But bride knoweth bride at the glance of an eye. And between them swiftly passes comfort and meaning in a language that man and widows wot not of. The romance of a busy broker, pitcher, confidential clerk in the office of Harvey Maxwell, broker, allowed a look of mild interest and surprise to visit his usually expressionless countenance when his employer briskly entered at 9:30 in company with his young lady stenographer. With a snappy good morning, pitcher, Maxwell dashed at his desk, as though he were intending to leap over it, and then plunged into the great heap of letters and telegrams waiting there for him. The young lady had been Maxwell's stenographer for a year. She was beautiful in a way that was decidedly unstenographic. She forewent the pomp of the alluring pompadour. She wore no chains, bracelets or lockets. As he had not the air of being about to accept an invitation to luncheon. Her dress was gray and plain, but it fitted her figure with fidelity and discretion. In her neat black turban hat was the gold-green wing of a macaw. On this morning she was softly and shyly radiant. Her eyes were dreamily bright, her cheeks genuine peach glow, her expression a happy one, tinged with reminiscence. Pitcher, still mildly curious, noticed a difference in her ways this morning. Instead of going straight into the adjoining room, where her desk was, she lingered, slightly irresolute, in the outer office. Once she moved over by Maxwell's desk, near enough for him to be aware of her presence. The machine sitting at that desk was no longer a man. It was a busy New York broker, moved by buzzing wheels and uncoiling springs. Well, what is it? Anything? Asked Maxwell sharply. His open mail lay like a bank of stage snow on his crowded desk. His keen gray eye, impersonal and brusque, flashed upon her half impatiently. Nothing, answered the stenographer, moving away with a little smile. Mr. Pitcher, she said to the confidential clerk, did Mr. Maxwell say anything yesterday about engaging another stenographer? He did, answered Pitcher. He told me to get another one. I notified the agency yesterday afternoon to send over a few samples this morning. It's 9:45 o'clock, and not a single picture hat or piece of pineapple chewing gum has showed up yet. I will do the work as usual then, said the young lady, until someone comes to fill the place. and she went to her desk at once, and hung the black turban hat with the gold-green macaw wing in its accustomed place. He who has been denied the spectacle of a busy Manhattan broker during a rush of business is handicapped for the profession of anthropology. The poet sings of the crowded hour of glorious life. The broker's hour is not only crowded, but the minutes and seconds are hanging to all the straps and packing both front and rear platforms. And this day was Harvey Maxwell's busy day. The ticker began to reel out jerkily its fitful coils of tape. The desk telephone had a chronic attack of buzzing. Men began to throng into the office and call at him over the railing, jovially, sharply, viciously, excitedly. Messenger boys ran in and out with messages and telegrams. The clerks in the office jumped about like sailors during a storm. Even Pitcher's face relaxed into something resembling animation. On the exchange there were hurricanes, and landslides and snowstorms and glaciers and volcanoes, and those elemental disturbances were reproduced in miniature in the broker's offices. Maxwell shoved his chair against the wall, and transacted business after the manner of a toe dancer. He jumped from ticker to phone, from desk to door with the trained agility of a harlequin. In the midst of this growing and important stress, the broker became suddenly aware of a high-rolled fringe of golden hair under a nodding canopy of velvet and ostrich tips, an imitation sealskin sack and a string of beads as large as hickory nuts, ending near the floor with a silver heart. There was a self-possessed young lady connected with these accessories, and Pitcher was there to construe her. Lady from the stenographer's agency, to see about the position, said Pitcher. Maxwell turned half around, with his hands full of papers and ticker tape. What position? He asked, with a frown. Position of stenographer, said Pitcher. Who told me yesterday to call him up, and have one sent over this morning? You are losing your mind, Pitcher, said Maxwell. Why should I have given you any such instructions? Miss Leslie has given perfect satisfaction during the year as he has been here. The place is hers, as long as she chooses to retain it. There's no place open here, madam. Countermand that order with the agency, Pitcher, and don't bring any more of them in here. The silver heart left the office, swinging and banging itself independently against the office furniture as it indignantly departed. Pitcher seized a moment to remark to the bookkeeper that the LD man seemed to get more absent-minded and forgetful every day of the world. The rush and pace of business grew fiercer and faster. On the floor they were pounding half a dozen stocks in which Maxwell's customers were heavy investors. Orders to buy and sell were coming and going as swift as the flight of swallows. Some of his own holdings were imperiled, and the man was working like some high-geared, delicate strong machine strung to full tension, going at full speed, accurate, never hesitating, with the proper word and decision and act ready, and prompt as clockwork. Stocks and bonds, loans, and mortgages, margins and securities, here was a world of finance, and there was no room in it for the human world or the world of nature. When the luncheon hour drew near, there came a slight lull in the uproar. Maxwell stood by his desk with his hands full of telegrams and memoranda, with a fountain pen over his right ear, and his hair hanging in disorderly strings over his forehead. His window was open, for the beloved janitress spring had turned on a little warmth through the waking registers of the earth. And through the window came a wandering, perhaps a lost odor, a delicate, sweet odor of lilac, that fixed the broker for a moment immovable. For this odor belonged to Miss Leslie, it was her own, and hers only. The odor brought her vividly, almost tangibly before him. The world of finance dwindled suddenly to a speck, and she was in the next room 20 steps away. By George, I'll do it now, said Maxwell, half aloud. I'll ask her now. I wonder I didn't do it long ago. He dashed into the inner office with the haste of a short trying to cover. He charged upon the desk of the stenographer. She looked up at him with a smile. A soft pink crept over her cheek, and her eyes were kind and frank. Maxwell leaned one elbow on her desk. He still clutched fluttering papers with both hands, and the pen was above his ear. "Miss Leslie," he began hurriedly, "I have but a moment to spare. I want to say something in that moment. Will you be my wife? I haven't had time to make love to you in the ordinary way, but I really do love you. Talk quick, please. Those fellows are clubbing the stuffing out of Union Pacific."
"Oh, what are you talking about?" exclaimed the young lady. She rose to her feet and gazed upon him, round-eyed.
"Don't you understand?" said Maxwell, restively. "Want you to marry me. I love you, Miss Leslie. I wanted to tell you, and I snatched a minute when things had slackened up a bit. They're calling me for the phone now. Tell them to wait a minute, pitcher. Won't you, Miss Leslie?"
The stenographer acted very queerly. At first she seemed overcome with amazement, then tears flowed from her wondering eyes, and then she smiled sunnily through them, and one of her arms slid tenderly about the broker's neck.
"I know now," she said, softly. "Tease this old business that has driven everything else out of your head for the time. I was frightened at first. Don't you remember, Harvey? We were married last evening at 8 o'clock in the little church around the corner."
After 20 years, the policeman on the beat moved up the avenue impressively. The impressiveness was habitual, and not for show. Four spectators were. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.